Our collective nightmare, the House Oversight Committee, handed the country a new slideshow from Jeffrey Epstein's estate. The pictures look like someone left a catalog for the powerful in a haunted thrift shop. They show President Donald Trump, freshly re-elected in 2024 and now occupying the Oval Office in 2025, rubbing shoulders with a roster of the untouchable: Bill Clinton, Steve Bannon, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, Alan Dershowitz, Larry Summers, Prince Andrew, and a who's who of people who get better explanations than consequences. The photos are petty and grotesque at once. A bowl of novelty condoms with a cartoon Trump head that says "I'm huge," a carved pumpkin with a sign reading "Trumpkin, make Halloween great again," a room with a dentist chair and masks on the wall like props waiting for a show, Epstein in a bubble bath, Epstein photographed with a book called "Filthy Rich" held over his face, piles of sex toys, men who run the world framed on the wall next to redacted photographs of women. Small humiliating things for giants. 70 more pictures were dumped on a Friday, part of roughly 95,000 images the estate produced. Democrats released a fraction, Republicans screamed cherry-picking. The White House called it a hoax. The committee's defenders said it's about transparency. Nobody produced a clean story that makes sense. Nobody explained why a man who abused people and trafficked them collected such a glittering crowd beyond the obvious answer. Power smells like opportunity. Legal teams say the photos were minimally redacted, nudity covered, and that none of the released images show sexual misconduct or underage victims. That is both fact and a dodge. A photograph is a record, not a verdict. It is evidence of proximity, invitation, and common cause. It is not innocence. The images raise questions the court system has not yet answered, and the people pictured keep naming procedural reasons why the pictures mean nothing. Congress passed a law forcing the Justice Department to hand over Epstein files by December 19th. Republicans who pushed the law threaten criminal charges if the DOJ stalls. The administration promises cooperation while calling the whole spectacle politically motivated. The survivors asked for truth. Washington offered a timetable and talking points. This is what our politics does now. It collects archive after archive of impropriety and packages them as theater. We get pumpkins, condoms, photos of a bathtub, and men who run things who never run out of plausible deniability. The real thing we're waiting for. Accountability, consequences, a moral center, is still absent, enjoying the same immunity as the men in the pictures. The photos are not pretty. They are familiar. They are the same story we've seen since power learned to hide behind charity logos and quiet donations. Proximity without penalty, social capital without scrutiny, spectacle without shame. The images will circulate, the spin will tighten, the deadlines will arrive. The survivors will keep waiting. The powerful will file statements and move on. The state of the nation. A gallery of bad taste and careful silence captioned by our inability to do anything other than look.
Only in the first world does a human tragedy get folded into a corporate brand crisis checklist so fast you can almost hear the PR team high-fiving. Coach fired with cause at noon. Charges filed by evening. University issues a statement promising to uphold respect, integrity, and accountability between paragraphs of union bylaw compliance. It's restraint with a logo. We watch the TV feed, and what do we debate? The jumpsuit. He shows up in an all-white jail outfit, and Twitter becomes a seminar on tasteful monotones. Meanwhile, the person who says they were terrorized is trying to keep a roof over their head. The national pastime isn't baseball anymore. It's judging who looks best in mugshot couture. Then there's the legal choreography. He's not a flight risk, says the attorney, as a GPS tether gets clipped on and his passport stays firmly in the file. Cabinet. We haven't seen the discovery, says counsel, while prosecutors read aloud a script so cinematic it sounds like it was written by the same team that scripts halftime shows. The cadence of "I can't comment" is now its own genre of performance art. And the language, law and bureaucracy meet motivational poster. No contact in any form or fashion, the judge says, which covers calls, texts, emails, and presumably smoke signals and singing telegrams. It's the legal equivalent of blocking someone on all social platforms and then blocking their number 3 more times for good measure. Universities issue statements promising a staunch commitment to campus culture and then schedule a committee meeting to figure out the right hashtag. The headline gets updated. The link gets a new date, and people on message boards argue about coaching replacements like they're drafting fantasy regulators. The loyalties shift from real people to roster spots and recruiting cycles. There's also the spectator sport of mental health shorthand, evaluated, not admitted, turned back over to law enforcement. That sentence, functions like a pause in a sitcom where the laugh track forgot to switch off. This is the weird thing about first world outrage. We're extraordinarily good at treating trauma like a scheduling problem. We want swift action, transparent accountability, and also three hot takes an hour. We will demand listings of punishments, timelines, and whether this will affect the bowl game, all while pretending to mourn the erosion of trust in the same breath. Punchline: the real first world problem isn't the crime, it's our capacity to turn someone's worst day into everyone else's content calendar.
The administration quietly unveiled a $100,000 price tag for an H-1B visa and called it governance. It reads better on paper as restoring integrity or reducing overuse. In practice, it is a financial guillotine aimed at anyone who helps run a hospital, teach a class, or keep a lab from collapsing. Pay the surcharge or watch entire professions shrink like unpaid utility bills. Blue state attorneys general have filed suit, arguing the Department of Homeland Security invented a six-figure surcharge Congress never authorized. Their claim is simple. You cannot rewrite immigration law by invoice. The states say the fee will choke hiring, saddle employers with impossible costs, and turn vacancies into permanent failures. Thousands of educators and health workers, tens of thousands, by the numbers being tossed around, are already on the hook. There is a predictable performance. Federal agencies issue the rule, affected institutions raise alarms, states sue, and reporters make lists of numbers. Meanwhile, empty positions accumulate in schools, hospitals, and research labs. The result is not chaos by accident, but a slow, bureaucratic attrition that looks suspiciously like a plan. Make staying or coming here prohibitively expensive, then sigh when services falter. Litigation is the polite countermeasure. California has filed dozens of suits since January, a legal relay race against administrative overreach. It is heartening in the way watching someone stand in front of a bonfire with a garden hose feels heartening. Heroic, but probably insufficient. The Justice Department declines comment. The Department of Homeland Security has been pinged. Institutions keep taking the hit. Labeling this a policy choice understates the cruelty. A $100,000 gate at the border of professional life is not enforcement so much as exclusion by invoice. If talent can be priced out, then shortages become natural and failure becomes inevitable. The fever dream of dismantling public serving systems looks less like sabotage and more like an accounting decision with human casualties. There will be rulings, appeals, adjusted regulations, and press conferences. There will also be fewer teachers, fewer doctors, fewer researchers. That is the point, whether it is admitted or not. Change to governance that accomplishes collapse by paperwork is both elegant and obscene, efficient in its cruelty, absurd in its logic, and entirely unsurprising.
Based on the article Geminid Meteor Shower from the provided content, which cites Earth Sky and the American Meteor Society, tonight a stream of gravel from an overcooked asteroid will remind us that the universe is not subtle. The Geminids arrive like an RSVP we never sent, particles shed by asteroid 3200 Phaethon, flung into Earth's path by extreme heat, and now on schedule to make our night briefly brighter and our problems look a little smaller for a few seconds. Astronomers call some of these streaks fireballs because calling them burnt rocks making a cameo lacks scientific gravitas. Fireballs are easier to spot, colorful, long-lived, and brighter than any planet you use to chart your feelings. If you're under suburban skies, you might see about 20 meteors an hour. In semi-dark areas, you could catch 40 or 50. In the countryside, one a minute is possible. In other words, your chances of witnessing cosmic debris are roughly proportional to how good you are at avoiding light pollution and responsibility. If you want to be efficient about your awe, the practical instructions are almost disappointingly human. Northern Hemisphere viewers should look low in the east around 10 p.m. Southern Hemisphere, look north around 2 a.m. The early ones, Earth grazers, tend to linger a second or two longer because they skim the atmosphere instead of diving in like commitment-phobic lovers. Photographers, who try to bottle transience with 15 to 30 second exposures, will appreciate that Geminids are slower than Perseids and Leonids. Slower meteors equals better star trails and better evidence you were present when a piece of space decided to combust dramatically for you. The moon will be about 34% full, which is to say it will be responsibly intrusive. Keep your back to it, and you might still see things. That sentence sounds like bad relationship advice, but it's accurate for meteor watching. There's a small, tragically beautiful irony here. We schedule viewing parties for a dust trail left by an asteroid that keeps circling the sun like it has a purpose. We point expensive cameras, cut down our screens, and lie on cold lawns to watch tiny bits of rock do something that, in geological terms, doesn't care about our plans. We catalog the colors and call them fireballs. We give the stream a name, Geminids, and then we go home, slightly elevated and mostly unchanged. If you miss the peak, the show isn't gone. The Geminids are forgiving for a few days before and after, though the peak falls off faster than your motivation after a 3-hour documentary about entropy. And if you prefer seasonal symmetry, mark December 21 to 22 for the Ursids, a final, quieter encore during the winter solstice, when the night is at its longest and the sky feels almost obligingly dark. Maybe this is why we look up, not because the universe is offering consolation, but because it presents spectacle that refuses to explain itself. Meteors don't promise meaning, they simply burn, streak, and disappear. We watch them anyway, taking photographs, timing exposures, and telling each other we felt something profound. That feeling, brief, bright, easily missed, might be the closest thing to meaning the cosmos sells by the hour. Bring a blanket, bring a camera, bring a tolerable sense of irony. The rocks will do the rest.
The capitalist fever dream tickets for the World Cup have become a ledger of moral bankruptcy. A final seat now lists for more than $4,000. A loyal fan who has tracked the national team through wind and rain for years is handed a choice: bankroll an obscene sum or watch the spectacle from a sofa. What had been a cultural festival is being priced into a boutique commodity. FIFA's participating member association allocation is the sleight of hand. Tickets funnel through federations and loyalty schemes, so the most devoted, the irregular heartbeat of the stadium, can be auctioned to the highest available conscience. Those schemes demand not devotion, but capital. Football Supporters Europe calculates that following a team from the first whistle to the final now costs at least $6,900. That's nearly 5 times the outlay from the last tournament. Loyalty inverted into extraction. The math is worse in practice. England's cheapest ticket for an opening game sits at $265. If England reached the final, the lowest price final ticket is $4,185, and the top is $8,680. Fans are told this is an affordable World Cup as they are handed a bill due by early 2026. Affordable becomes a PR shim for what is plainly profit maximization. FIFA advertised $60 group stage tickets in the abstract, a sop to sentiment that never reaches the people who make the atmosphere worth paying for. National associations don't get access to the cheapest tiers. Instead, every match will be priced according to demand, so supporters from different nations pay wildly different sums for the same stage of the competition. Market signals, not tradition or community, now determine who gets to sing. The consequences are obvious and obscene. Atmosphere erodes when terraces become vitrines for those who can afford spectacle. Travel, accommodation, and visa costs are piled on top of fattened ticket prices, turning fandom into a luxury itinerary. Supporter groups that once brokered solidarity are reduced to account managers for FIFA's revenue stream. Representatives call it a betrayal. The governing body calls it commerce. This is not a series of isolated pricing errors. It is a symptom. Culture commodified, access gated, rituals sold to the highest bidder. The World Cup's claim to universality fractures under simple economics. When loyalty becomes a monetizable asset and tradition bends to dynamic pricing algorithms, the game we love is made to serve a balance sheet. The roar in the stands is being replaced by the muted clink of credit cards.